Doesn't that computer know who you
are? Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is
me. A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same
thing. I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my
onto
friend?
A Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I'd probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah.
This is Tech Talk. Good morning. This is Tech Talk. Michael Tech Talk Caster. I'm hoping anyways, that I've got our good friend Dave Sparky Saganaki going to come on with us here in just a moment. I guess we'll find out if he's going to pick up or not. But either way, we'll be bringing on, of course, our good friend Jay Geek Trivia Garmin at jgarmin.net. He's going to come on and talk to us not only about our geek trivia this week, but I'm going to hit him up. There was some news on the convention scene this last week here in Chicago with the Chi-Fi convention, science fiction convention. So I'm excited and interested to hear his take on that. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Also, too, of course, have another number of exciting news and views and all sorts of good stuff. Oh, I think that might be our good friend, Mr. Dave Sparky Saganaki. You with us?
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Ah, there he is. There he is. All right, we got you. I heard you come through the first time, and then for some reason it just didn't drop in properly. Which is so bizarre for us to have weird technical problems here in the morning as we try to bring everybody on air. So good morning.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program.
Fantastic. I was just saying, there's big convention news coming up. I'm going to have Jay on here to talk to us about his take on this, about the Chi-Fi convention in Chicago being canceled because of some people at the hotel, and we'll talk about that. But we'll also talk to him a little bit about Conglomeration Convention, which is happening in Louisville in April this year, and which the Tech Talk show has been invited to come down and do a little live broadcast from. So I think we're going to actually make that happen this year.
And what's the date for that?
April 11th through the 13th is the date. It's at the Louisville Ramada, I believe it is. And we'll have more details as we move forward. But Jay and I have been in conversation about making that happen this year. So
that sounds exciting. I can't wait to be a part of that.
I'm thrilled. And I know I haven't mentioned it to you. So I'm mentioning it to you for the first time on air. And we need to have you physically there, Dave. You have to be there. We can't do this Skype thing. Louisville's even further away from Canada than Chicago, so we can't take the chances. I'm going to make sure we get everything arranged technically as much as I possibly can. We'll get our lines and our mics and our speakers and whatever else we need to make it a successful event. I think we'll have a lot of fun. I think it's going to be a good time. So we'll talk to Jay about that in just a few minutes.
It'll be exciting. It'll be the first time we've ever done it all with everybody live. And I mean, in the same physical location.
You know, that's, you're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, I mean, I was thinking about this the other day as I was talking to my wife about setting this trip up down to Louisville. I've only in real life met Jay one time, and that was when we were on a family vacation down in Louisville for Thanksgiving a few years ago. And so this is big stuff. I'm really excited, and any chance we get to see you is a good thing. So this will be if it can happen. I'm getting excited already. My heart's racing. This is going to be a blast. It'll be be so much fun to make this happen. So, you know, before we bring Jay on, though, I was going to bring up a couple of other just small news items. I don't know if you had anything interesting or exciting that happened that you saw, but there's just so much in the news lately about all of these hacks and losing credit card data. The geek trivia question of the week this week is, you know, what was the largest one in history? But I think that trivia question that Jay answers, it's got a short period of time before it's going to be wrong. Neiman,
the answer might have changed this week, right?
Exactly. Neiman Marcus, I don't know if you heard about that. They apparently sat on or did not realize, I don't know the full story here, I don't think anybody does yet, the fact that they had been hacked back in July. Okay, so they didn't identify the security breach until mid-December, about the time that Target's hack was becoming known, but they were actually hacked back in July and had for 6 months or more the possibility of essentially an open database of credit card numbers and all that other good stuff. They had malware, they had all sorts of things running rampant all over their stores. The point of sale terminals had been the primary avenue for data theft, with malware installed on those point of sale terminals. So when you go and you ring your sale up and they put in your credit card, it's kind of like one of those skimmers, except it was a software skimmer that was taking the credit card information that was being entered and texting it or emailing it directly to the bad guys.
Oh no. You know, I have to tell you, I received an email from Target this week with tips on how to be more secure when I shop on the internet shop at Target.
Actually. And it said, number one, don't shop at Target. Number two.
I've got some tips for Target.
I think a lot of us do. Yeah, well, fortunately, I'm not rich enough to be shopping at Neiman Marcus, or Needless Markup, as we like to call it around our house. But Target, I'm a, I'm a big.
That's a good one. I like that.
we've got all sorts of nice names for these companies. But yeah, but Target, you know, it's a tough thing. I think the main tip, you know, and we talked about this last week, is if you can avoid it, avoid using those debit cards or use, you know, one-time or limited funded debit cards. You can create a debit card and say, I just want $100 on this card and use that, you know, that type of thing. You can even, too, you know, one thing that I've done in the past, and this sounds crazy, but you can get, you know, with your credit card, you can get gift cards and use them yourself. You can gift yourself a gift card. This is actually a very secure way to use money because you minimize your risk considerably. Now, of course, you're basically, you've got cash in this card form in your pocket, which is a concern, but a lot of times, you know, you can apply your discounts. People don't know this. You can apply your discounts that you get to gift cards in many cases. So we get a 5% discount at Target fairly regularly. And, you know, go get a Target discount card. You get a $100 card and it only costs you $95. I mean, hey, it's only $5, but $5 is $5. And now you've got a card which, if it is hacked or cracked or whatever else, at worst, you're going to lose, you know, your $90 to $100. So an idea, anyways, for people.
Yeah, that's certainly one strategy. Oftentimes, you know, during the Christmas season, they've had gift cards. Many vendors have gift cards at a discount. Mm-hmm. You get a $100 gift card for $90 or $80, something like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and if you shop at that store with any regularity, that's free money. Why? Why would you not do it? It's the same thing with like Starbucks. Starbucks will do the same thing too, where, you know, if you do an auto reload on your card, or if you get, you know, a pound of coffee, they'll give you a Starbucks card for free, you know, or, you know, $5 or $10 or whatever. And again, it's like kind of like why would you not do this? It's free money. But yeah, so something to think about. And of course, your Google, we talked about Google Wallet, allows you to load some of these cards into there. It tends to be, though, the Visa card, debit card type of things, not the store specific cards, although there have been different solutions for that, you know, with greater or lesser success, mainly lesser success. So we'll see how that goes. So I don't know what to tell you. I shop online mainly instead of in the store, which I think reduces your chance at least of getting physically skimmed. But, you know, and using a credit card versus a debit card, of course, is a good solution and tactic. Making sure, as with anything, that your passwords are not replicated and duplicated all over the place, so that if they get one, they don't get all of them. But, you know, with your credit card info, it's... You know, it's tough. I don't know what to tell people, really, beyond some of those basic, what should be relatively common sense ideas now. You know, track your credit score all the time. I use Mint. I use Mint.com. And the nice thing about that is that actually alerted me before the bank did that we had an overdraft. We mistakenly moved money into the wrong account. I put it into savings instead of checking. We had an overdraft. The bank wasn't going to let me know. They were going to let me keep racking up the bills.
They've got too much to gain by you're not knowing, you know, in terms of late fees and such, or overdraft fees.
Exactly. So that's one way to go about it. So do you have any ideas yourself, Dave? Any thoughts about what makes the most sense or works?
Don't buy anything over the internet, and use cash. Of course. Yeah. Who's going to do that, though?
Yeah, Dave's now got a mattress full of not only dollars but loonies. He's got a bunch of loonies in his mattress here. It's wrecking his back. Yeah. But
no. I've always been nervous about this. I was a very, very early adopter for online banking, but at that time the banks had private networks that you would. Dial in. You would dial in to a private network, and I was the last guy to get off that. You know, when they went over to the internet, I really was. They were like, "Sir, come on, you're the last guy. You need to shut this down, please." Honestly, I was like, you know, I seriously thought about quitting online banking, but I was addicted by that time.
Yep. Well, and I've been just actually working to get my wife kind of into using some of the more advanced features. You know, one of the things you can do with the online banking now, of course, is if you are still getting checks from various sources, you can use those checks and... take a picture with your phone and upload the check to your bank that way without having to actually physically go into the bank and deposit it. And that's making a big difference.
Yeah. I've written maybe 10 checks in the last 5 years or if it's that many. So yeah, online banking is the best thing since sliced bread. It's so convenient, so easy, but, you know, and so is shopping on the internet with your credit card and such. You know, that's like Christmas, you know, when the UPS or FedEx guy shows up. But it has its risks, I mean, and some of that we just have to accept, I suppose.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, yeah. I think it's absolutely right. You know, I one of the things that I always kind of have in the back of my head is, you know, people really freak out about this stuff. I think part of it is because of the scale. You know, it's kind of like the perceived risk of flying on an airplane, and how we perceive that risk is much, much greater than driving, because we don't have the control over driving or control over flying that we do when we drive. And also, too, because when there is an accident in an airplane, it affects a large number of people all in one go. And so our perceived risk for flying is very high, even though the reality is it's exceptionally low, far, far lower than driving. I think it's somewhat similar here with the credit card hacks and so on through, you know, the Target thing. Now, there's always been the possibility that your credit card would be hacked and stolen and used and identity theft would occur, but it used to happen in a small scale. People would grab the garbage cans outside of restaurants and take the carbon copies and use those. The waiters and waitresses and managers and busboys or whoever that had the opportunity to pass your credit card through their hands would write down the numbers and take them and use them in identity theft that way. Now it just happens on a much larger scale. It affects more people, and so that perception of risk is much higher. I don't know if the reality is that it is any higher, though. You know, you hear about these, the debit card stuff, but the credit card stuff, not as often, I don't think.
And, I haven't dug deep into this, researching a lot of articles. However, I haven't heard a lot about the dollar amounts lost because of this. The numbers they talk about are always about how many credit card numbers were released or how many PIN numbers were released. But the dollar amount loss is not forthcoming usually.
Yep. Well, I know who has the answer to that.
Why don't you ring him up?
Our good friend Jay Garman has got the answer to that one. So I'm going to see if we can we can pull him in here. Go ahead.
No, just be prepared to be scared. When Jay starts talking about this, we're all going to be cutting up our credit cards at the end of the show.
I know it. It's true. Exactly. Good morning, Jay.
Jay.
Hey.
Hey, fellas.
Hey, we got you. All right. We got the whole crowd on tap here today. This is awesome. We were just talking about, I'm going to cut right to the chase. We called you because we got to the end of our knowledge. That usually takes about 15 minutes. And and again today it
no,
did.
It doesn't.
We're done. So no, we were talking specifically about the Target hacks and the Neiman Marcus hack, which has just been exposed, even though it had been going on for 6 months or so. And we're wondering if we were going to jump into the answer to the geek trivia question, which was, you know, what was the largest payout for a credit card hack in history? And thought maybe you could put some perspective answering that question, but then put some perspective in of how dramatic are these hacks? How many people are affected and how much is it costing?
Well, the largest hack in history, which was, well, let me rephrase this. For some context, there's always two numbers, at least two numbers, attached to any breach. There's the number the company cops to, and there's the number the security experts say could have been breached. Because what really happens in these situations is they realize that someone has had access from this date. And between this date and the date they fix the breach, X number of transactions have happened and X number of records have been exposed, if you will. There's really not generally a way of knowing how many of the records the hackers went in and copied or how many of the transactions they skimmed. Because if they knew that, they would have caught the breach earlier. So, and also, you'll note, when I did a little research into this question for last week, these breaches almost always tend to be announced in like early to mid-January because they get caught when the companies close their books at the end of the year.
Wow.
Yeah. So the number that really, really, really matters to sort of give you a sense of scale of a breach is what the party that failed its due diligence settles for. Because the amount of money they pay to make someone whole or to make the problem go away sort of tells you how bad it was. And the worst ever was the Heartland Payment Systems breach, which the breach began in May of 2008 and was discovered or announced by Heartland, at least, in January of 2009. And for the next year, basically, they had to go. Now, Heartland Payment Systems, for those that don't know, runs the back-end transactions for a whole bunch of companies like MasterCard and Visa. So them getting breached is a big, big deal. And so between MasterCard, Visa, and a few other payers, they totally settled out for $110 million.
Wow. $110 million. That's crazy. I was thinking it might be, the TJ Maxx breach that happened a few years before that. And Customer Jones posted that as a response as well. But that was only like 10 million or something. So that's a whole order of magnitude larger on the payout.
I think Visa got like 40 million and MasterCard got like 60 million. And then like everyone else, I think like a Diners Club got like $3 million or something, you know. But it, like Visa and MasterCard between them were, I think, were 100 of the 110 million.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That is crazy, man. And, you know, it would be interesting to find out, and I know there's probably no way to do this, but to find out, you know, how many of those numbers were actually used and actually successfully used in a, you know, identity theft type of purchase. There was a really interesting, I don't know if people listen to Planet Money, but that's a great podcast as well, or show on NPR. And they did a rundown, in fact, talking to the FBI of these clearing sites for credit card numbers that you can go to. And if you have a big database of credit card numbers you want to sell, that's the place to do it. You can find a place to go sell these or buy them, vice versa. And this is big business, taking these numbers with the security codes. If they're validated and legit and you've got them, you can sell them and you can make a lot of money, and the people who buy them use them to make a lot of purchases and do a lot of nefarious things with them.
Well, and what's interesting about them is the reason you buy a bunch of credit card numbers at once is that these credit card companies have gotten so good at fraud detection that if you go and make a purchase with a card that's atypical for the card owner, that card's going to get locked pretty quickly, like maybe within hours. So what you're going to have to do is, like, if I want to go and buy, 10 speedboats, I've got to spread those purchases over 10 or 15 different cards, and I've got to be really good about where I make my purchases and know the card's going to get locked. And I've got to do purchases where I take possession of the goods immediately. It can't be like I'm going to make an installment plan or something. I've got to go get something I can get hard currency on, a hard good on really quickly. There's a whole like method to this.
Yeah.
It's really complicated.
Yeah. Well, and and that was one thing, in fact, that we were talking about just before before we brought you on, was, you know, one of the tactics that I gave for kind of avoiding some of these issues, especially if you use debit cards, would be if you know you're going to be shopping at a store like a Target or wherever, go and buy with your debit card or with your credit card, ideally with your credit card, go and buy a bunch of gift cards for there. And then you're minimizing your risk. But I can also see that being a tactic of someone who's got a bunch of credit card numbers to essentially turn those into cash by going and purchasing a bunch of debit cards and then, Visa cash cards, and then being able to do other things with those too, because those are treated as cash. Although I guess those are still trackable though at that point, right? Because you'd have the number, you'd still be going into the main system, so they could probably turn those off once they realize they have been hacked.
Well, and here's, you'll notice now, if you go and you make a return, say at a Target, for a purchase you bought on a credit card, the first question they'll ask you is, do you want us to put this back on your credit card? And the reason they started doing that, because it's actually a bit of a trouble for them to do that, is one of the tactics these guys would use, the low-level players that would sell like one or two credit cards to a street punk, is the guys would go in and they'd buy a bunch of stuff with the credit cards at one Target, and knowing the card was going to get turned off, go across town to another Target and return them immediately and ask for the cash back. That's a really easy way to launder the exact value of the good. It's like, all right, I bought, these 10 T-shirts for, $40 or $50 or whatnot because they were on sale.
Yeah.
And I decided I don't like them. I want them back. Just give me the $50 in cash.
Yeah.
A really easy way. Well, what now it's gotten to the point, like if you go back after Christmas, you want to do a bunch of returns, they don't give you cash as an option. Like if you're going to get returned more than like $40 or $50 in merchandise at a lot of Target stores, they're going to either issue you a Target gift card or they're going to put it back on the original purchasing credit card. They will not give it to you in cash for exactly that reason.
Man, yeah, when I suppose even if you made sure you had a gift receipt and did that, they'd probably force you to do the same thing and say, yeah, right. we'd give you that. Now, I used to work at Target. This is a long time ago, but the level of bad activity around this stuff has always been very high. I recall, in fact, that I worked there long enough. This is back in the day when people didn't care about lawsuits and personal safety and so on. I think it was a code white. If there was a Mr. White call to the front, that meant that all male employees were supposed to go to the front doors to try and respond to someone stealing things. And we had one incident where there was a family that would come through, and what they would do is one person would go stand in line at the service desk while one of the other members would go into the back of the store and pick out a number of items, and then they would come to the security the service desk and feed themselves back into line with the person who was waiting. And when they would get up to the front, they would take these items and say that they had purchased them but had forgotten their receipt. Could they get a return on it anyways? And Target was usually generous enough, they wouldn't give you a lot of headache for returns. That was one of their things. But the one incident that I remember was a guy and his wife and their very young child doing this. And when they realized that they had been found out, they took off running. And there was a Mr. White call to the front. And so we and our manager and so on were chasing them across the parking lot until they got into their car and took off. The man and the wife did, leaving their young son behind. So we escorted him to the security area. So they eventually did get caught, and then also had to face charges of child abandonment and endangerment, as well as everything else. But anyways, totally off the topic. But I was saying earlier today that I think there's...
Oh no, it was right, Michael. It was
right in the sweet spot for Tech Talk.
It went right to the core of the question. Yeah.
Well, the reason I brought it up though too was because we were talking earlier, and I don't know what your opinion is, Jay, but about the perceived danger has risen, that our perception of the risk of using a credit card, of using our information electronically, is much higher than it used to be when we were doing these things without these huge databases. And I don't know if it's true. I don't know if there is more or less risk to individuals or to companies. I think it's just bigger, instead of having a couple hundred credit cards at a single store stolen by one waiter or waitress, now you're going to have, hundreds of thousands of cards potentially. But really, is it that much more risky than it used to be? I'm not sure.
I would argue it's actually less risky, at least for the individual consumer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even going back to the Heartland payment system attack, Visa didn't not pay any of the bills made on those cards. That's why Heartland had to pay back Visa and MasterCard. Is the consumer was never out anything other than some inconvenience where, they had to, their card got shut down and they had to get sent, The risk we tend to run these days is, in terms of inconvenience, and there's probably a startup opportunity here somewhere, that I've got a bunch of automatic withdrawals set up on some debit and credit cards for like domain renewals and stuff like that, or my Google Wallet or my Amazon auto purchases or whatnot. And if a credit card gets compromised, Discover or MasterCard or Visa fix it, immediately let me know, shut down the card, but then I got to go to my gym and say, all right, here's where you get my $9 a month out for my membership now, because old Discover card has been shut down. Like, that's the inconvenience for us.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, in the old days, you lose your wallet, and it's like, oh, man, now I got to go to the DMV. I got to call up for my Social Security card, you know, all this business. Yeah, it's, I think that's right. I think that's right. It is a huge inconvenience. You know, and that's one of the tips that you see repeated frequently or always, you know, and you should have some external place where you have stored all of your credit card numbers, your license, driver's license numbers, you know, any security codes, and also the phone numbers that you would need to contact them so that you could, if you do notice that your card is stolen or that you see weird charges on it or anything like that, that you can immediately contact all of the places that you would need to and keep it going. Because there is a time limit on that too. You know, they covered all the charges, but if you didn't notify them for, you know, 2 months or so that you had some weird charges on your card, they're not going to cover it anymore. You're pretty much out of luck at that point.
Exactly. Like, you need to look at your statement every month. Mm-hmm. And there are other kinds of fraud out there, and I forget this guy's name, but there's a guy that's made tens of millions of dollars on really sketchy websites with free deals, and you got to put in your credit card number to get the free deal. Mm. And what this guy has done, and he's been fined, but he's never been arrested, because what he's doing is unethical but not illegal. It violates some terms of services for the payment processors he goes through. Is you sign up for these free deals or this like dollar a month magazine subscription or something else, and what you don't know is you've got all these fees you have to opt out of. They're all in the fine print of the user license agreement or the terms of service. But the fees are all designed to look innocuous. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's, you know, like, you know, American Transaction Services or something, and it's like $7.14. And, you know, or you know, U.S. Credit Investigation, you know, $8.12. And they do like every third month or every fifth month or every 7 weeks, so they're all at weird intervals, and they don't show up regularly, so you don't notice them, and they're never big amounts. And so you go through 5 or 6 months after signing up for the service, and you've paid the guy like $200 and not noticed it.
Yeah, because you don't know. Yeah, like you said, you know, if you're not really paying that close attention, you see these charges come through and they look somewhat legit, and you go ahead and go through. Now, I would say, you know, I use Mint, and Mint's pretty good about identifying not only charges but also too like bank charges. So if you have an overdraft or if you're being charged for, you know, something that seems a little off kilter, a lot of times they'll alert you to it, you know, and it's of course, you know, for your good, but it's also too in their own interest in that they're trying to sell you the, you know, services that they resell. You know, they're giving you links through to cheaper checking, you know, and things like that. But it's been a very useful service for me and my wife to have that sort of collected center of information that we can easily review and check and see anything weird that's going on. But you got to be on top of the stuff. Really what it comes down to is, as our good friend Money Plan Steve SOS would say, is paying attention and not interest. And in this case, paying attention and not not some guy's crazy, you know, weird fees that he's added in. So hey, you know, Jay, I want to talk to one of the reasons I wanted to get you on fairly early today too. I wasn't able to get through to James Dobbs, who is the Chi-Fi convention chair. Chi-Fi is an annual science fiction cosplay really fun convention that goes on here in Chicago. That's the Chi, part of the Chi-Fi. In the past, they've hosted it at the Westin Chicago River North, which has worked out very well for them. They did know some other places too, but they were trying and had, in fact, in a contract and engagement to have the convention set up here in March at the Chicago River North. It's a fairly large convention, so it takes some planning and effort. And in the process of getting set up for this convention, had a really bad situation occur where the staff of the Westin, the hotel management of that site anyways, not necessarily of Westin or Starwood itself, referred to the attendees and the guests excuse me, as freaks, and for some reason said that they wouldn't honor or did not want to honor the non-harassment policy that the Chi-Fi convention has. And basically they agreed to part ways in just the most, I was flabbergasted by this whole situation. It seems so strange to me. And this is not, I mean, the Chi-Fi, you may know more about Chi-Fi than I do, Jay. They don't strike me as being, you know, it's not like a, you know, like a swingers sci-fi club or anything, you know, outre or very off the reservation. It just seems like a very straightforward science fiction, cosplay, gaming, comics, and geek music sort of convention. Do you know anything about them that would lead you to think that, you know, the Westin would be... I can't say justified, but maybe we would clarify some of that?
No, Chi-Fi is fairly new, so they don't have a long-term reputation. I think this may actually be their first convention. I don't know that for certain. I think they're just getting started.
Mm.
But there's sort of the last couple of years, it's been a big deal after some stuff has gone down at a few places, including WorldCon and ReaderCon, that a lot of big-name guests won't come to conventions. They don't have a formally stated and formally enforced anti-harassment policy. And one of the aspects, and I've not read Chi-Fi's, but there's actually several sites where you can download a boilerplate anti-harassment policy, and almost everyone's based theirs off one of those two. Mm-hmm. And one of the main components of both those sort of boilerplate ones is if someone comes to con staff and complains that they have been harassed, and the staff feels, you know, the claim is somewhat substantiated, the perpetrator is... If the complainee, you know, the perpetrator is automatically revoked access to the convention, they're thrown out. And if the perpetrator wants to press charges, the con will help them do that. Well, the thing about thrown out is that means their badge is revoked and they're blocked from accessing convention areas.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of hotels, the convention area is the whole freaking hotel. There's like, we're lucky at Conglomeration, the con I help run, where our convention space is physically in a separate building. You got to cross about, you know, 100 feet of parking lot between the hotel and the convention space. So if we throw you out of the convention space and you've got a room at the hotel, that's not blocking you from anything. But if you are banned from the convention space, that, you know, that basically means, you know, one interpretation is you can't go in any of the meeting rooms or the hotel restaurant.
Mm.
But a more strict interpretation is you can't wander the halls other than to come and go. And I this is entirely supposition on my part, but I suspect that might be what the Westin was objecting to is, you can revoke them their badge access, but like we're not going to take any responsibility for throwing them out of the hotel. Like, they pay for the room nights, they can come and go. They can come in the restaurant if they want. If Chi-Fi is running what are known as Caffe Clatches, which is basically authors and guests get together in the bar and drink beer or coffee and hang out in small groups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a convention space at that point, but it's also the restaurant, so you can get this weird area of. The hotel's like, if this guy wants to come in and buy food from us, we're going to let him, and you can't make us make him go away.
Yeah, or and you, you, can you freaks the can't other, let us can't make us get. Yeah. Never mind. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, the other possibility is they want guarantees that if the harassees are hotel staff, that the hotel will send them home. And I that has never happened in Conglomeration, but I've been second party to. Places where the person doing the harassing is, you know, a hotel janitor.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets really sticky, and they sort of want, you know, we write language into our contract. If your hotel staff harasses our guests, you know, we get let out of the contract, or like there are financial penalties for you, and you know, you have responsibility there, so keep your staff in line. Now, we've been really, really lucky. We've been around since 2001 at our convention, and all but 3 years of that convention, we've been at the same hotel. We've left it and come back twice because even though we've gotten better deals elsewhere, we've never gotten better service. Like, they love us. We've got a great rapport. So we've been very, very lucky. But we've been at other places where we were at a convention, one of our conventions 1 year, where they booked, it was on Easter weekend, and they a Catholic school booked their Easter formal opposite us. And you were talking about not a good crew.
Yeah.
It's a mix with you know, sci-fi fans of all ages are awkward, you know, tuxedoed in evening gown teenagers and their Catholic school nun chaperones. Like, that was not... That did not go well.
That's hilarious, actually. That would have been that must have made for some fantastic photo opportunities. That's all I could think of. You know, the harassment thing, I had not thought about that aspect of it. I did read through their harassment policy, the anti-harassment policy that they've got, or harassment, however you want to pronounce it. But I didn't pick up on that. They don't say that explicitly about, you know, not allowed to walk around. So you're right, that might have been something that was discussed in those private meetings. It's a fairly boilerplate, straightforward, you know, basically no means no, and, you know, we'll help you do whatever we need to, whether it be press charges or expose, you know, they do say the... conference staff or the conference management has the right to do any punitive action that they choose that's appropriate for that. Now, this has been kind of a big deal, the harassment at these conventions, particularly over, I think, for some reason, I think there was a couple of incidents over the last 3 years or so that have really brought this more into the limelight. And I know, in fact, the first that I heard about it was not with a science fiction convention or Comic-Con or anything along those lines, but was actually with the skeptical community at TAM, the amazing meeting, which is had every year. There was an incident where a female attendee felt very imposed upon and harassed, and it wasn't by just guests, although that was part of it, but also too by one of the guests of honor who had been there, one of the authors, who essentially, it sounded like, treated the convention as a free ticket to, you know, date and get and hook up with who whoever he pointed a finger at, and so that kind of blew up and got this really into the center stage for these conventions going forward, that, you know, there needed to be some well-defined manner of approaching it and well-defined way of dealing with the fact that women are now really not just a part of, but a necessary part of these conventions, and that the attitudes and behavior that were being directed towards them was completely inappropriate and was very non-accepting and not accommodating to, you know, what really makes up, of course, at least 50% of the convention attendees, and detracts from the enjoyment of pretty much everybody when that's happening. Because the ones that are being harassed against, of course, don't like it. And for everybody that's around them who's not the actual harasser, it's an extremely uncomfortable situation. If anyone, you know, like myself, has been in that situation, you have that problem. It's like, what do I do? Do I need to step in? Is this somebody they know? Should I, you know, get all masculine and manly here and try to protect the damsel in distress? Is this something that, I mean, I know that, and I think you and I have talked briefly about it before, Jay, so I know it's not something that has come up at conglomeration specifically, but is this something that you're seeing happen more frequently in the convention scene, that they're really trying to crack down on this?
Yeah, it's being more talked about. There's one of the terms of art that at least some of the groups I've talked to look sort of reuses, the assumed groupie syndrome, which is there are 99% of the time male celebrities in these areas, authors, artists, whatnot, that have been, you know, very famous for decades, and they sort of, you know, when they started in the 50s, 60s, 70s coming to these conventions, they were predominantly male. Mm. And the only females at these conventions, not only, most of the females that came, because it wasn't mainstream, were sort of groupies. I mean, that's not the only one there. They sort of assumed that the only ones there were groupies. And in the 60s, you know, the 70s and previous, that assumption, no one ever disabused them of that.
Yeah.
And they sort of keep that mindset that they assume everyone there is a groupie and want that attention. And that's just not the case. There's plenty of ladies that attend these conventions that just generally enjoy the fandom that aren't just total Star Trek groupies, and that's generally been true the whole time, but it's sort of come to the fore now, and I think that's sort of been a large issue that a lot of the old time sort of celebrities and authors have had a real hard time adjusting, especially at larger conventions that have media-centric guests, where people who made big roles on TVs and movies and sci-fi and fantasy, mm-hmm. you know, they're used to groupies in general. They're not actually used to engaged, intelligent fans of the medium, because they're from Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
So they have a really hard time with that. But I think the other part about it is a guy who's been to a Dragon Con, of really much larger conventions. I mean, there has been sort of a, and this gets complicated in fandom, at least in my experience, there is an aspect of fan culture where this is a place to meet and date. Because for nerds, you know, a group I am proudly a part of, it's not easy to get dates in conventional culture. When you sort of come to this safe zone where everyone understands you, this is a place where you can meet people who are interested in you and get you and understand you. And so that is a part of it, but it's sort of a dangerous mixture when you get people who are there looking to meet people, but a lot of the lookers and the lookees are very socially awkward and don't understand social cues and boundaries and whatnot. So you get a lot of benefit of the doubt, and there are absolutely scuzzballs that have learned to prey upon that benefit of the doubt.
Mm. Yeah.
And so we've sort of gotten to the point now, like, look, you don't. The geek is not a get out of free card anymore. To get out of jail free card, it's like, it doesn't matter whether you're socially awkward or not. We're going to hold everybody to this standard, and if that means you don't know how to interact with the opposite sex now, just don't. Like, we're going to be upfront and say about it. If you don't know when you're being creepy, just stop.
Boy, and that's, I mean, how do you teach that? You know, it's if you haven't figured it out by the time that you're old enough to attend some of these conventions, I think it's tough, and that's, you know, that's why that you know, these policies come into play. You know, to that point of the dating too, I can't recall where I saw this, but I watched one evening, there was a really interesting little documentary on the speed dating concept, but being done at one of these cosplay conventions, and it was really interesting. They did it as a true speed date thing. Everyone was in costume. That was being run by someone who, you know, was one of the leaders of the convention, and they cycled people through. And there was actually some very successful opportunities for people, as you say, that perhaps have less experience or less confidence in social interaction, period, but particularly social interaction with the opposite sex, that it was a really interesting way to manage that situation. You know,
You guys have given me a great idea for a booth at the convention, teaching social skills.
Hey,
you know, it's funny you mentioned that, Dave. That is one of our programs. That conglomeration is, you know, yeah, how to deal with these issues. Like, we tend to do that very early on Saturday, which is our main day, to sort of set the tone of, here's why we have a harassment policy, here's some very basic rules. You know what the word no means? It actually means no. You know, if a girl has her back to you and is not talking to you, it's not okay to come up and touch her. You know, mm-hmm. you know, don't assume friendliness. You know, if she initiates physical contact, that's one thing, you know, and it's amazing how much that works. And to Mike's point about the speed dating, a lot of conventions have sort of set that up to say, all right, this is going to be the approved space for romantic interaction to begin. And outside this space, it's assumed you shouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of this, all right, we're going to draw sort of a firm boundary, like, you want to go meet somebody here, that's great. Here's when and where we're going to go do that. So we're going to have two or three sessions or something like that. And the rest of the time, just assume they're not looking for romance and just let it go.
Yep, yep. Yeah, and, you know,
what are you going to call it, the hormone zone or something like that?
Well, I like it.
Oh, please. We've got so many euphemisms in geekdom. For old school next gen fans, you are looking for Jamaharon.
Oh man! Well, I know with Chi-Fi they refer to it. I saw they've got like an adults only session period. You know, where clearly that's kind of where the direction is. You know, we're getting close to the end of the show though. So you know, fingers crossed, Chi-Fi I know will rise above this and get this sorted out. Dave and I were talking before he came in on air. I was sharing with him our plans to come down in April 11th through the 13th down to Louisville, where the conglomeration session is going. Couldn't be more thrilled and excited about that, and we're hoping to get everything arranged and coordinated that we can do a live show from there on that Saturday. But even if we can't do live, we'll record it, we'll have a blast. Whatever happens, it's just going to be a great time. So people can find conglomeration stuff at conglomeration.info. They can find Chi-Fi stuff if they want to send out some support to our brothers in arms at Chi-Fi at chi-fi.org, and there's news and updates on there as well, and you can follow that. Really disappointing they're not going to make it. They actually had Jim Butcher lined up as one of their guests of honor, so that's disappointing that they're not going to be there. I believe also too, Tim Russ and Garrett Wang from the Star Trek New Generation we were talking about we're going to be there as well. So you know, it's a disappointing situation. Jay, what should we be thinking about though for next week?
Well, Google made headlines this week because they bought the group that makes the Nest learning thermostats and smoke detectors and so on and so forth. And it was the second biggest acquisition that Google's ever made. They paid $3.2 billion. The biggest ever was Motorola at $12.5 billion. Now, the thing about Motorola and Nest is those are both hardware manufacturers. They have a lot of tangible assets. That's sort of why those numbers are so astronomically high. They also have a lot of patents. So the question is, what was the most expensive Google acquisition they've ever made for a non-hardware company?
For a non-hardware company. Interesting, interesting. Wow, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, because now I know they've done a lot of robotic stuff, and obviously that's all hardware stuff. That's a great question. I don't.
That sounds very. I can't wait to hear the answer to that one.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jay, I'm going to let you go. I got to slide into Kids Talk Tech here with Justin. I'm going to let you go. We will be talking soon, though, again about conglomeration, of course, and we'll keep that on our radar here in the coming weeks as well. Have a great week. Stay warm, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Stay warm, buddy.
Yep. Take care.
Take care.
Jay Garman at jgarman.net. You can always find him. I gotta bring my good friend here. We got Kids Talk Tech with Justin. Justin's having tech difficulties right now with his iPad. I can see he's taking the tactic that I often take with my hardware, which is the harder you hit it, the better it'll work. I don't know if it's working.
You know, that actually worked for me. That actually worked for me this week. I've had a mouse that I've had. A wireless mouse that I really like, an old Logitech mouse, mm-hmm. that hasn't worked for a while, and I just slammed it on the counter, and it works great now.
It's like the frying pan cure for amnesia, you know? So, yeah. So.
Oh, and I also wanted to mention, we forgot to mention Lou and Darlene from Australia. They sent us a lovely e-card over the holidays. Somehow we forgot to acknowledge them on air.
Absolutely did. Yes. It was a beautiful card. Now, they Lou and Darlene are in Australia and longtime listeners. We love hearing from them. And they're going through quite the heat wave right now as we're dealing with our cold wave. I got to get Justin moving here, though. Hey, Justin, so you have a new app. Now, we've played this one together. So
it's not exactly new.
It's new enough. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
It's called Quiz Up.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you've played it.
And I have played it against each other, in fact.
Yes.
Now, Now, Quiz Up, of course, sounds like exactly what it is, which is a trivia game, and you can play against people. What do you like about it?
Well, it has over 250 completely separate, unique topics.
Mm.
And you get to level up by playing them against other people in real time. And you get to level up in all of them separately. So right now I'm in like level 20 at definitions. And level 1 at like level 2 at Disney movies or something.
What level are you in Harry Potter?
I think like 32 or so.
Yeah, that does not surprise me, being a Harry Potter expert as yourself.
Yes.
So, now, interestingly, QuizUp, you may not know this even, Justin, QuizUp is an Icelandic production. The company is called Plain Vanilla.
Yes.
And the CEO is a guy named Tor Friedrichsen. And they've been quite successful by adding not only this social aspect, like you mentioned, where you can play people.
Well, that was actually in the original, the first version ever, because that's basically the point of the game. You play against other people who are playing this game and that topic in real time.
That's right. And you can also you don't have to do it real time, though. Like if Dave and I wanted to play against each other or against you, he could be up at a different time and answer his questions, and then I would get a notice that he had made his, you know, his move, kind of, and then I could play him then.
Yeah, it was really confusing.
That sounds very cool.
It was really confusing trying to play against a different person, different person that you actually knew, mm-hmm. instead of a random person, which is default.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't we have trouble with that?
Yeah, well, trying to make it happen in real time, like you said, against people that you know, is somewhat catch-as-catch-can. All the stars have to be in alignment, you need to be connecting at the appropriate time, all that good stuff has to kind of happen, otherwise you're not going to be able to play in real time against people. One of the really neat things, the thing that they did very well, though, is that they got a large number of experts in specific topics and got questions from them. And also to have created a forum and each of those topics. So if you love physics, you can go in and you can do QuizUp physics, and then you can kick off into the physics forum where you can chat about string theory and all sorts of other fun stuff while you're taking a break from playing trivia.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts, definitely.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? It is 2 minutes to the end of the hour here. I know we've got Rob shot first. Rob Rigel is on deck. He's ready to come in. He's going to talk a lot more intelligently about string theory and other fun science, cool, exciting stuff than I could. And so I am going to take us out, I think, Dave. I really appreciated you coming on today again with us. Next week, we're going to have Hartmut Esslinger on. Herr Esslinger is going to talk to us about how he was one of the original designers of the Apple II, the aesthetics of it, the look and feel, and what eventually turned into, he worked directly with Steve Jobs and eventually, in fact, influenced greatly, greatly the look and feel of what we now know as the Apple look and feel. He has a fantastic book out calling Keeping It Simple, and I think it's going to be a really exciting, interesting interview that we can talk about. I'm going to take us out with, let me see what I want to do here. Oh, wait, Justin's got one last thing to say.
What?
Oh, I thought you were pointing at me. You said you wanted to say it. I guess not. What?
In the App Store here,
yes.
Out of 11,986 people reviewed, there's an average of 4.5 stars.
Okay.
But I really don't agree. I give it a 5.
He gives it a 5 stars, guys. That's QuizUp for you. Everybody, you've been listening to Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois. Don't walk away. We've got Rob Rigel coming on in just a moment. I'm going to leave you with the podcast-only song of the week, More Than Life by Whitley. Dave! Thanks again. Have a great week. We'll be talking very soon, I'm sure.
See you next time. Bye.
Take care. That was Dave Sparky Zaganaki. Okay, we are out of here. More Than Life by Whitley. Have a great week, everyone.
a leaf in the breeze, the smoky morning haze, the sun on her face, and the touch of lover's hands, the pain that comes today is here, then goes away. And we are homeward bound, and I want this more than life. I want this more than life. I want this more than life. To touch something real will help your wounds heal, like the sun on your face, dreams, starry nights. And we are homeward bound, and I want this more than life. I want this more than life. I want this more than life. This more than life.